If you want to hear about the opportunities that we are presenting to our investors, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club. We scour for the best opportunities and present those only to folks inside the club, and that is the only way you'll hear about our deals and what we're working on. We'd love for you to be a part. Again, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club.
Don't rush into it. Don't hop into buy a property because you find a great deal, because if you don't have a great team behind you, that property is quickly going to turn, you know, turn to mush, basically.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Paul Sion is a real estate agent licensed in Ohio and Kentucky and an attorney licensed in Ohio and Michigan. Paul works with real estate investors, helping them secure small multifamily properties as well as home buyers and home sellers to help them realize their real estate goals. As well, Paul can help you on the legal side with all of your contracts, as well as leases, tenant leases, anything that pertains to the legal side of your real estate business, Paul can help you out with. It's not every day that you get both the 1-2 punch of an attorney as well as a real estate agent. Hey, Paul, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
Man, this is great. This is great. It's not very often that we get to interview somebody who is kind of the multi-tool of real estate investing. For a lot of us, we either interact with our brokers / agents on one hand and then our attorneys on the other, but you come in all in one package. So I'm excited to have you on today and just learn what it is that you do exactly. And, you know, the same questions we ask everybody is kind of where'd you start? Where are you now? And how'd you get there? But if you can kind of give us that, you know, with the spin of what it looks like that from that perspective as an agent and attorney, I'd love just to hear your insights.
Yeah. Just a basic intro. Started off, you know, was in law school a number of years back and, you know, living at home. And my mom said, hey, she knew a broker out there. I was in Michigan at the time, did all my schooling there in Michigan, currently in Ohio though. But did all my schooling there. And then while in law school, she said, why don't you go work with this broker as an agent? You know, that way you can pick up some experience, some knowledge. And I said, sure. Did it for a summer during my, I think it was after my second year in law school. So got my Michigan license, was licensed there for a number of years. But then we moved down here to Ohio, let the licenses go. I was in the military reserves at the time. So kind of had a full plate there, you know, full-time job, military reserves. And once I got out of the military reserves, just, you know, there's a lot of travel and a lot of other things to kind of keep up with as shift my schedule more towards family life. I got a couple of young kids and a wife, so just shift that. And then I'm one of those guys who, you know, I need to keep myself busy. You know, I like the quote I like to say is busy rather than bored. So once I had that extra free time, I mean, I decided to get my licenses back again. So in 2014, I got both my Ohio and my Kentucky real estate license. So attorney-wise, I'm licensed in Michigan, which I was born and raised, went to law school over there. And then when I came down here to Ohio, after a number of years, I decided to get my Ohio license, attorney license, just so I could do some work over here for clients here. And that kind of led me to, you know, networking, meeting a lot of people, and basically working now with a local law firm here as an of counsel. And then I do a lot of real estate work, contract work with them, and then do my real estate sales work on the side as well, too.
That's interesting. So I bet you can draw in a lot of clients just because you can service kind of both sides of the transaction.
Yeah, definitely. I do, you know, I do mention to my, both my buyer, you know, buyers and sellers on real estate side, as well as the legal clients. Hey, if you, you know, like you mentioned, one-stop shop, if you need some help, you know, I've got dabbled in some, I shouldn't say dabbled. I've, you know, I've got some experience in landlord tenants. So just, you know, I don't do the evictions now. There's, I kind of try and hone in, specialize on certain things, but I've got a deep network too. So if somebody does need, you know, hey, I need an eviction attorney, or hey, I need, you know, I need to sue a tenant or sue a contractor, I've got litigation attorneys that I can loop in and then go that way. But my main specialty is, you know, contract review, drafting contracts, as well as, you know, first real estate sales, you know, leases, landlord tenant leases, commercial side and residential side.
Right. And that's really great, you know, for us from the investor's perspective to be able to come to you and just say, hey, look, not only can you help me acquire the asset, but then you can also legally, you know, review our documents, you know, to make sure they're legally compliant. And then, you know, help us even review our leases and things like that to make sure that they are really sound. So what are some things that you would advise your clients to do, maybe that you see other agents aren't necessarily, you know, watching out for?
I guess one of the things I kind of go back to is, as an agent, and I went through the same training that every agent has, is they tell you, you know, you can use the form contracts that you get from the MLS or from their, you know, your state level body. You can use those, but in terms of customizing it, if there's a blank in there, like you can add a date, you can customize it that way. You shouldn't be adding legal language in there. So if you're adding certain contingencies that, you know, if they don't read incorrectly and they end up going against your client, that client can turn around and sue you, versus as an attorney, you know, I'm experienced at it, and as well as I understand that contingency too. So not saying that the real estate agents aren't experienced at it, but they do have, most states do have a prohibition against real estate agents from actually practicing law unless they are, like myself, they're a licensed agent. You know, if they do get into that and some, you know, everything goes south, the buyer or the seller is mad at their agent, I mean, that's an easy, you know, if I were the attorney going with that case, that would be an easy, you know, wedge there to go after them to say, hey, you were practicing law without a license. That's one way I'm going after you.
Interesting. Yeah, because I mean, gosh, a lot of times the agents are drafting, you know, quote unquote, legal language in the, you know, other sections or whatever you want to call it, the bottom of the contract. It's like, well, we're going to add this and we're going to add this and add this. So what do you suggest we do? Take that back to our attorney if our agents come to us?
Even yeah, if you have an attorney, generally, most agents, they work for a broker if they're not a broker themselves. And, you know, the broker should have, especially the larger brokerages, they usually have a general counsel or some sort of attorney services over there. I used to work for a large brokerage a couple of years ago when I started off in Ohio. So they had an attorney that we could always reach back to, you know, if you had a question. Now there's, you know, depending on the market now, especially with everything so fast, you might not have that time, but it's still best and advisable to do that. And, you know, even if you have to slow it down or just leave out a provision and just kind of work with the offer and then see if you can, you know, if it's something that you really need, then you might have to wait just to protect yourself.
Gotcha. That's interesting. That's really interesting. Yeah, not something I would have necessarily, because you would assume that most of the time those are fairly benign additions to a contract, but it sounds like that's a common pitfall. What else should we necessarily be looking out for?
I guess my process when I'm taking residential, multifamily, or even commercial real estate clients is, you know, we have to look at all the numbers, kind of, you know, I can't judge for them what they need, what they want, but I'll present them. I'll get everything that I can from the other side and say, here's what we go. Here's what we got. You know, you kind of need to do the math and you need to do the numbers, and I'll make sure that, you know, hey, okay, this lease looks good, you know, or, you know, I'll look at something simple like zoning. You know, you're buying a multifamily, you know, they converted it later on, but they didn't get the necessary permits, or they're out of, you know, no permits, or it's zoned for single family and they're running a, you know, a three unit in there. So, hey, it might be a good deal, but that's why it's a good deal, because they're running illegally, and you never know when the city will turn around and say, hey, this is illegal. You need to kick out two of your tenants there. And that's going to be a big pain to deal with then too.
Right. It sounds like you've encountered that.
I've seen some, and like in most of my clients' cases, you know, that's, you know, first thing we're checking too. I mean, if there's other multifamilies next door, that's kind of an easy, you know, an easy way to figure it out. But if you're in a kind of a middle of a neighborhood and, you know, they're the only duplex in there, then that's a question that always pops into my mind. Let me go check the zoning just to make sure that, you know, this is a legal multifamily versus just, you know, it's supposed to be single family.
Right, right. And from your perspective, so now we've covered contracts, we've looked at zoning a little bit. What are some other things, again, because you pack kind of the 1-2 punch that either the attorneys are miss, or that the agents typically miss, that you say, hey, I've got this perspective and these are things I think that both of you should be looking at?
Well, one thing to look at too, especially with the big push in rehabs, is the permits. You know, if you're not getting proper permits, depending on your area, your locale, you know, the permit varies. You know, in our case here in Cincinnati and in Northern Kentucky, majority of it, as long as you're not changing the existing walls, you know, if you're just updating a bathroom, updating a bedroom, you know, you're fine. If you're starting to knock down walls, add bathrooms, add certain features, extensions, and you don't have the right permits, yeah, you can do it. You know, most times, you know, might not even be caught, but if you are caught, or if you're, you know, if I'm representing the buyer, I'm going to make sure, you know, I'm going to ask, did they pull permits for it? If they didn't, then I'll let the buyer know, well, hey, this is why it's a deal. You don't have the permits, but there's a potential that if they come back and say you don't have the permits, they can make you either undo the work, or they will make somebody, you know, some other contractor come through and, you know, meticulously document everything. And they're not going to do it for cheap either, just to make sure that, you know, they can go retroactively apply the permits.
Right. I can't imagine going through the permitting process retroactively. That sounds like a nightmare.
Yeah. Actually, you do have a client who did that and got a great deal on a property. It was a two unit, you know, so partly he should have known, and then partly the title company should have caught it, but there was a condemnation on it. So, you know, nobody was living in there. He thought it was a great deal. He went through, bought it, you know, updated it, rehabbed it, put in new tenants. And then the city comes along and says, hey, where's your permits? You know, did you take it out of condemnation? He goes, I didn't know it was condemned. And unfortunately there was the seller didn't disclose that, the title company didn't catch that. So I don't know if there was an issue with the city. They didn't post it in time, depending on closing. But after he closed on it, after he owned it, it was kind of incumbent upon him, but there were no notices posted. But unfortunately, you know, he's kind of out of luck. They forced his tenants out, saying it's condemned, even though it's a, you know, I've been through the house. It was perfect. I would live there based on the way he had updated and rehabbed it. It was, you know, perfect. Put in all the plumbing, did everything pretty much by code. I mean, he's not, you know, we don't have licenses here per se, and you don't have to have a licensed contractor unless you're getting permits. But in his case, you know, I use him as a contractor, so I know his quality is very good. And like I said, I would have no hesitation in living in that unit. But the city said, no, you know, sorry, it's condemned. You didn't go through the right process. You need to take your tenants out.
Wow. That's something to look out for sure. I would have thought that, you know, that the title company would be on the line for something like that if there were a condemnation prior to closing.
Yeah, and that's something. I mean, he's a contractor now. Everything's busy and crazy, so he hasn't really had a chance to go back and kind of address it. You know, he's come back to me and asked for help, and I've been trying to help him. But at this point in time, it's kind of like, you know, hey, you know, whenever you're free and you want to start working on this, let me know. We'll get back to it. But at the same time, too, it's, you know, we have to kind of go back and, you know, was it on the deed? It should have been on the deed. It should have been on the record. I mean, if it wasn't, then not necessarily the title company's fault. Could have been something somebody at the city was just a little late in filing it. You know, I don't know if the seller even knew. I mean, if the seller knew that they were required to disclose. So there's a lot of, you know, potential issues there. But, you know, he got it for a good deal. And, you know, getting the permit process, getting it taken care of afterwards, I think it's going to be more cost effective than suing somebody for, you know, some piece of property he got for like, you know, $7,000.
Right. Yeah, there is that where you just have to look at the overall cost and say, well, whatever, I still paid a very reasonable rate for it. So when it comes to writing leases, and since you help out a lot with that, how has writing leases changed for you in 2020? I know we've had a lot of weird eviction moratoriums and just, I mean, wacky stuff going on. So what's that look like for you?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say it's necessarily changed per se, and the process still the same. I mean, my advising process for before you bring on tenants is basically if you're doing it yourself or if you have a great property manager. I used to own a four unit where we had a great property manager, and luckily while we owned it, we didn't suffer any negative effects from the virus shutdowns. We did have a few late rents, but ultimately they were paying, and he was keeping on. So I mean, with, you know, if you're self-managing, you know, you may basically just got to screen properly. You got to find the right tenants and, you know, go back, look at their history, look at their rental history, talk to their previous landlords. Why are they moving? What's the, what are they looking rent wise? I mean, it's one of those, you know, hey, we need a place tomorrow and we're ready to pay you, you know, double the security deposit, whatnot. But that's kind of a red flag to me too. It's like, you know, they're ready to rent tomorrow. It's like, I don't want that kind of person. I had experience with that with a prior property manager who put somebody in, you know, they wanted to move in next week. And sure enough, within a week or two, they stopped paying their rents. And so it's those red flags and those kind of things people need to be on the lookout for.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's interesting. What would you say the percentage of your business is spent doing the legal side versus the agent side?
I would say probably it shifts at times too. I mean, with the real estate market being so hot now, I'm doing a lot more real estate work. So, I mean, we're probably at the, you know, 60, 70% real estate, you know, 30, 40% law. And then there's times when, you know, it's a couple of years ago when it wasn't as hot, then it was kind of 50-50 balance.
Right. And you're in the Ohio, Northern Kentucky. You said you're based out of the Cincinnati or greater Cincinnati area.
Yes. Yeah. I live in Cincinnati area, but I'm licensed in Ohio and Kentucky, and I service the Northern Kentucky area.
Right. Right. I gotcha. That's awesome.
In the past, when I was in the military, we had a house at the time we were living in. It was a brand new development, new construction. So I was called to active duty, going to move to Fort Bragg for a year. Kids were young. They were, you know, not school yet. So I told the wife and kids, let's just all go together. We'll hang out in North Carolina for a year. So that new house couldn't rent it out because, or sorry, couldn't sell it because it was a brand new development. So we would have taken a loss. And so at that time, it was like, let's just rent it out.
Sure.
Found a, you know, what was a decent property manager at the time. And they took care of it for a while. Towards the end there, they kind of, you know, went off the rails, ended up selling that. That was the one where I mentioned that, you know, they're the ones who stuck in a tenant there who wanted to move in within 1 week. You know, then we kind of got out of that. And then my wife was like, you know, she doesn't want a single family anymore. We wanted to invest in a multifamily.
Oh.
So we got a 4 unit then back in 2016, kind of got it before everything started running up here in Cincinnati.
Right.
That was a good deal. I tried self-managing at the time. I wanted to see did I want to go into that line of work? Did I want to be a property manager? You know, it was an interesting experience. You know, it was with everything I do, it was like one of those things like, you know, okay, I'm biting off more than I can chew. Let me, you know, I did it for a couple of years. It was just too much. There was days too, and I wasn't doing it effectively because I just didn't devote the time. But that's right. When I was like, you know, I have no issue now paying a property manager, whatever they're going to take. They took care of it. You know, once I transitioned it within a month or two, I mean, I didn't have to visit at all.
Right.
You know, I literally didn't visit it for, you know, a year plus then after that. Just recently when we were selling it, then I had to go there once or twice just to handle a few things. And other than that, it was, you know, cakewalk. So that's kind of one of those things where I personally was like, you know, if somebody wants to do it themselves and that's all they have to do, that's fine. But in my case, you know, scaling my time, using my time wisely was better pointed towards the law and actually helping clients buy properties.
Right. And what are the typical, you know, unit sizes that you're seeing, I guess, trading hands right now in your market?
A lot of interest in the 4 and under just because of the conventional mortgage. I mean, anybody buying a 4 and under, you know, 2 to 4 multifamily, 2 to 4 units, they prefer the conventional mortgage. You can get your, you know, your 30-year mortgage. Your interest rates are slightly higher than owner-occupied single family, but still pretty good to, you know, to lock away that for 30 years. And especially if you're cash flowing, you're getting enough cash per door, then it's a great, you know, a great investment. That's why we did it. And then when you're in the 5 or above units, then you're in the commercial space in terms of the mortgages. And so for that, with the commercial mortgages, you know, you're rarely if ever going to find a 30-year fixed mortgage. You know, you're looking at, you know, maybe 5-10 year lock on the rate. I mean, they might amortize the mortgage over 20-25 year at most. So your interest rates are also going to be much higher, and generally your down payment requirements are going to be much higher.
Gotcha. That's interesting. Yeah, the 4 and under is moving quite a bit, and I can see that, especially with interest rates coming down so low. If you're getting a non-commercial loan, I don't know where we are right now, but you know, we're hearing in the twos, maybe the 2.5% to 3% right now, which is, you know, almost crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this is being recorded mid-December 2020. So this won't come out until January 21, but even so, I can't imagine things are going to move quite a bit from there. So that property management company, and let's talk about that just briefly. You kind of went through the property management phase and said, no, I don't want to do that. And so one of your keys to really focusing your time and effort was outsourcing that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, even while property managing, I outsourced the maintenance. I did a few things myself, but I can't, you know, I'm not that handy. So I had to hire people to do that, and did meet a lot of good contractors, and I still keep them on my database. And that's one of the other big benefits too, is that, you know, I've done it, been there, done that, have all the networks in place. So somebody needs help with doing something, I was like, here, talk to this person over here, and they're a great connection. They'll help you out, you know, and I've got, you know, contractors, I'll tell them these guys are busy as heck. But, you know, if you want somebody quality, you want it done right, then same thing. I mean, unless it's, you know, the heater's gone and tenants freezing in the house, then obviously, yeah, you need to do something right then and there. But, you know, if you can wait a little bit, then it's better to wait to get that quality contractor that, you know, they don't charge the most, but they're not going to be that quick out to you either because they're just so busy.
Right, right. That's awesome. So people come to you, they can find contractor recommendations, they can get their legal work done. You will be their agent, and then you can plug them in with a property management company. It's a one-stop shop.
Yeah, I try to. I mean, I think that's ideal. And a lot of times people come and, you know, they talk about when, you know, you want to buy real estate, you got to build your team. So I try to, you know, try to fill those multiple roles in the team. You know, I've got the legal background. We need to review contracts. We need to prepare leases. You know, you've got a potential eviction issue. You know, I'm happy to sit down and talk with them and say, okay, this is what you got eviction wise. I did my own evictions while doing as a property manager. So I'm familiar with that stat, but build your record, build your, you know, keep logs of everything, keep track of everything that's going on anytime you communicate with your tenants and that type of thing. So it's always ideal to have somebody like that on your, you know, on your side.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Paul, this is great. Let's jump into the final four here. If you were to take everything you know about law and real estate and distill it down to one piece of advice that you were giving to an aspiring investor, what would that one piece of advice be?
Find your team. I mean, even if you don't have one person to do it all, you know, find your team. You know, don't rush into it. Don't hop into buy a property because you find a great deal. Because if you don't have a great team behind you, that property is quickly going to turn, you know, turn to mush, basically.
Right.
So, you know, find your, build your team, make sure you trust them. Use word of mouth, you know, look at reviews, and then go forward from there.
Right. That's awesome. What's one thing you're currently doing to stay on top of your game?
I love to read. I love to network. So reading is big, and networking. And part of it, we mentioned that earlier too, I podcast as well. And so I'll podcast with a lot of local people, with lenders, inspectors, you know, appraisers, home stagers, and just share that information. It's, you know, podcast is free out there for anybody. And then, you know, meet the people. It's like, hey, this is, you know, quality people, and let's network and let's get everybody out there.
Right. That's awesome. When it comes to giving back, what's one way you're making the world a better place?
I guess with this pandemic too, I mean, you see all the, you know, the kind of the unemployment, everybody's suffering. So I'm a big pet charity, a couple of pet charities here are the Free Store Food Bank and La Soup. I mean, they're great. You know, basically Free Store Food Bank is a food bank. You know, they're helping, you know, helping people, you know, get food and eat. Same thing with La Soup. You know, they basically take foods that's normally, it's still good to, you know, consume, but that normally they're going to be thrown away by, you know, the big grocery stores. They use it, they repurpose it, they make fresh meals for people to eat. So they're a great, you know, great service here. Another thing I do is I do, since I'm active social media, and I know a lot of the, you know, posting, you know, SEO and all that stuff on the internet. So I do volunteer work for an organization called SCORE, where we just advise small businesses. So it's like a new startup business, and I'll sit down one-on-one with them, and we'll say, hey, you know, here's what you need to do. Here's how you can market your business. Here's what you need to do, you know, business planning wise. So that's, you know, I'll do that one-on-one with these small entrepreneurs.
That's awesome. I might need to look that up, because that's that sounds like a great way to give back. And especially right now when entrepreneurs and small businesses are really taking it on the chin kind of across the country.
Yeah, they're nationwide SCORE. So they, each large city has their own chapter. You could just SCORE. And probably look at like small business and SCORE on Google, and I'm sure you'll find them.
That's awesome. Paul, if our listeners want to get in touch with you, what's the best way to do that?
Via email. You can email me, paul@realcincy.com. That's paul@realcincy.com. That's my MLS-based website too, realcincy.com. So, you know, you got my email over there, phone number as well too. So feel free to reach out, realcincy.com, CINCY.com.
Awesome. Paul, thank you so much for your time. It was great having you on.
Thanks, Sam.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.